We certainly appreciate tonight each of you who come from wherever you have been, some of you quite a long distance and some of you closer by, but you've all been coming so very well, and we're grateful for that. I suppose we could wait till tomorrow, but I'll say tonight that we certainly do appreciate so much the brethren from Tucson who've come over and over and over again, time and time again, to be with us. It's certainly been a great help to our work that we are doing, and for your presence and fellowship, we're certainly grateful. We're glad, too, that Ray and Debbie have been mentioned through today to be with us, and each of you who have not met them yet, of course, we want you to do that after services. I want to introduce them to you a little bit by some things I know about them you should know, and then we'll proceed to our study tonight. It's very interesting, something to have today, and I'll bring that up to you, too, in the course of our conversation. Debbie has been a member of the church for a number of years. She was reared in a Christian family. Her background, as far as her grandparents are concerned, was also as a member of the Lord's church. So she has a long, long record with the Lord and His people, and of course for that we're grateful. And we mentioned some things last night about being reared in the Lord's church. But Debbie has long, pretty black hair, as you know. She has dark eyes, and she is attractive in a way that so many people in my part of the country are not. Unusual, but she attended a university named Jacksonville State University in Alabama. I think she has 2 degrees from there, by the way. I know that all along as she was coming home from college, she would bring, or there would come along in the course of the weekend, some of her friends from college. Quite often they would be dark-haired young men with a mustache, and they'd be Islamic in background. Because, you see, Jacksonville had a lot of international students there. For some reason, it seemed to attract those. When I was at the bank, I used to handle a lot of money coming from overseas, a number of different places, for the students there at Jacksonville State. I don't guess Debbie even knew that. But anyway, she would. We had a chance to visit a lot of Mohammedans that way, and others, of course, because, as I said, she was attractive, and I think they probably liked that long, dark black hair that did that. Well, one time she brought home a little fellow with her named Ray. I may have mixed up a little bit, but that's about the way it goes. Ray, as you might well see, too, has dark hair, a little dark skin, dark eyes, and he was attracted to her, too, for some reason. But this fellow sort of stuck. She liked him, I think, and he liked her. It must be because they had 2 children. Anyway, the fact is it worked. Well, they have been able to develop into fine young Christians. They have, as you well know now, 2 children. They've developed into fine leaders in the Lord's church in their own rights, and we're very proud of both of them. Ray has an unusual background that you'll learn, not from me tonight, but later on as you talk to them, but he was a Roman Catholic. Now, that's something that we talked on several times this week, and several of you were, too. And you may want to talk with them about that. Interesting background, as well as both of his parents are concerned. And so he knows what I have been talking about, because if one thing, he's heard this before. And another thing, his background has been very interesting, and he has come a long, long, long way in learning the truth and adopting the truth to his philosophy of life. He has understood the truth as we know it. He's extremely conservative. And because of this background, he has been well qualified to preach and to work in a number of places where he moves on his job. He's an engineer, electrical engineer for Alabama Power Company. And he's been very effective, as Debbie has, too, in her background role in influencing the Lord's church in various places. But in the meantime, he has taken hold of publishing a monthly bulletin called The Harvester. And a number of copies are, well, there were some. There's not but about 3 left. There's a whole pile of copies of The Harvest on this table a while ago. And he wants you to know, of course, that you're welcome to a copy of it. No subscription cost. They pay most of it out of their own pocket, almost all of it. And if you want a copy and we put it on the mailing list, of course, they'd be happy to have you do so. A number of you receive it already. So we're proud of them, proud to have them with us. Today, down in Knockholz, we're passing back over the border. As is customary, the rude and sarcastic American border guards. I'm glad to say that, because that's what they are. Right, Bill? Most of the time. Occasionally you get a nice one. But anyway, they cornered us again as usual. She reached in and she wanted to know what nationality we were. And so I told her United States. And she looked around and she saw Ray sitting back there with dark hair, dark eyes, dark skin. She said, "Where were you born?" I'm sure she'd never heard this before. He said, "I was born in the canal zone." There was a moment of silence. She couldn't think of what to say. I knew she never met anybody born in the canal zone. But anyway, Ray was born there. So he's a foreigner from way back, but he was born to American parents, and so he's an American citizen. And most of all, he's a citizen of God's kingdom, and that's what's important. But we're glad to have them, and of course, glad they saw fit to come our way, and certainly glad, too, that Truman and Jim have been, as well as the rest of you, but particularly these, because they've wanted to get involved in the Mexican work, see what's going on. They already have a little taste of it, and they're going to get a big, big, big bite of it before it's over with, and we're thankful for that, and thankful for the support Ray and Debbie have been throughout the years in the work I've been doing, and I'll just tell you that very sufficiently. They have been backers all the way in numerous ways to me and my work, and I'm so thankful for it. Tonight we have a rather detailed study, and I'm sure I'm glad you don't go to work in the morning, because that means you can stay a little longer. Bill said I still need to go to sleep, though, so maybe he can find a few hours tonight. I want to review a little bit where we are, because most of you have been here. But last night, some of you were not here, and I want to review for your benefit at least where we stand. And then we'll proceed tonight in a little unusual approach. I don't usually do it this way. Usually in these studies, I go into chapter 16 and verses about 14 on down, the 6th and 7th vial, as a part of the book of Revelation, just a continual flow. But we've had so many questions asked. All over. I don't know how many times I've been asked to talk about what's going on in the Middle East. Where do we fit in with Iraq? And a number of things like that. And I mentioned that earlier in our study 2 weeks ago, and I think we'll tie some of those things together. So after I get through with this review, we're going to pass some handouts to you. We don't have enough to go around to everybody, but probably one to a family, at least that many. And you'll have those in a moment to look at. But right now, let's view where we stand. We know already that we have been talking about the book of Revelation having to do with the Lord's Day, or the Day of the Lord, which has to do with the entire Christian age from the time it begun back in 30 AD until the end of time. And we have seen fit to go forward progressively, because John saw fit to do that by naming seven churches which are representative, we feel, of seven distinct periods of time in the Christian age. Now, we talked about earlier the Ephesus church as the beginning time of the Lord's church on the earth. And then Smyrna came next, which is a time at which God's people begin to be affected in one way or another by the pagan Rome, to the point at which finally God saw fit to shake it apart and move the capital over to Constantinople in 326 and brought to an end the threat of pagan Rome. But instead of pagan Rome, Christianity was allowed and then finally became the official empire religion. That had to do with the seven seals. Now, the Church of Pergamos shows a period of drift and digression, which was involved in the times after that, beginning with invasions from the north. Rome now begins to crumble as an empire. And then eventually the southern part of Rome was taken over by the Islamic movement. They in turn were conquered by, as well as the last part of the Roman Empire, the Turks. Now, lest I forget it, I don't think I will, but lest I do, when I talk about the Turks and their invasion, and Rome being the power on the scene, if I don't mention the Byzantine Empire, understand that that's the part of the Roman Empire had to do with the people around Constantinople, and the last third of the Roman Empire used that name. Later on, we'll mention that, I hope, and I'll say if I think about it. But anyway, here's the Roman Empire and the various three invasions that were made against it to bring it to a fall. That had to do with the seven trumpets. That brings us up to a time of pause between chapters 13 and chapter 15. Chapter 14 tells us, in effect, there's a pause. And we must go back then to 533 to find out there was some going on in the Lord's church. Now, it was the Lord's church. But as I mentioned earlier, there was digression. There was corruption. The Lord's church was going into an area of digression, a weakness, and a lukewarmness that was not good and proper at all. They had begun to be complacent to the point at which finally there arose among the Lord's people a digressive organizational structure to where the local church no longer became itself governing body, but it had a hierarchy over it, then a hierarchy over that, to the point at which finally the Roman hierarchy jailed into where it had a supreme one-man ruler of the entire world. Now, later on, there was a conflict between Rome and Constantinople, and the Greek Orthodox Church emerged out of this conflict And the Roman Catholic Church emerged out of it as well as two distinctly separate different churches, and they exist that way today. But nonetheless, this was where the Pope had his beginning in 533, and he maintained his power and sway until 1793, which was the end of 1,260 years. And we have this diagram on the board, and if you didn't get a copy or didn't understand it, we'll talk to you after services about that. Some of you might not have been here. So during this 1,260-year period, Rome began to be a very powerful and influential force, and it had added to the seven heads, which Daniel mentioned, and which John has mentioned, which were the seven empires the devil used as a tool to wreak havoc on God's church and God's people. The seventh head was the papacy. In the meantime, an eighth head arose, which is the Holy Roman Empire, which joined with the papacy, and together they controlled, had a lot to do with the domination in a very awful way over the entire area of Europe and wherever they could have effect. So this was the second two-headed beast we find mentioned on the scene. The first was from the sea, the second was from the land. It involved the papacy on one hand, the Holy Roman Empire on the other, and they maintained absolute control of Europe during the time called the Dark Ages until finally God saw fit to raise people like John Huss and like Peter Waldo from about the middle of the 1100s on down to 1793 and eventually shook Rome loose from its power and its prestige and glory and its image, and Rome fell. Now, it didn't fall completely, because Paul tells us that the Pope would not be removed completely from the world until Christ did so at his appearing. But as far as his image, his power, his glory, his influence, it is gone. Now, there's some vestiges of that left, of course, just like Babylon was destroyed, but you can still see the ruins of it. And just like Jezebel had long since died many, many decades, years, centuries ago, but John still mentions her by means of influence, so her influence still even continues to our day, and did in those days. But the Pope has seen his doom, and he does not have the power and the glory he one time had. But during the time of Thyatira, which was a 1,260-year period of time, there began to arise these persons who had opposed Rome. They became known as Protestants, and that's pictured by the Sardis Church, which seems to indicate sectarianism and denominationalism arise. Now, from that period of time, we turn to the church at Philadelphia, which is a word that means brotherly love. It's a word that denotes a return to the first love, that is a love back over here in the beginning. We talked last night about that by trying to show that in the 1700s, they emerged from the Dark Ages, from the wilderness where the Lord's church had fed into. There arose a movement to return back to God and His church and the truth as it had been to start with. To the extent that the Lord's church came out of the wilderness, it was another movement back to God, as Israel had done time and time again. God allows Christians now to return back to God. So, rather than having a reformation, this is a restoration. So, the Lord's church is restored to its former glory and beauty and might and power. And Daniel said in chapter 2, verse 4-4, it would never pass away. And it didn't. But it came back out of the wilderness at this time. And we mentioned a number of places where this occurred. And some of you have been to some of those places. And we today here in Sierra Vista, and in Idaho, and Oklahoma, and Colorado, and Mexico, and other places where you know of and where we work, we are a direct result of that coming back out of the wilderness, because we are the church. We are the woman who emerged out of the wilderness when the Dark Ages were finished. You remember that in our study last night, we found that there was to be an angel, and he did, proclaim from the clouds to the Lord to thrust in thy sickle, because the time has come to reap. And we mentioned that the Catholic powers are being reaped. Well, Brother Edward tonight brought along something we talked about last night. Here it is. This is a sickle or a scythe. This is precisely what we're talking about. In fact, it even looks like what we're talking about. It has an extremely long blade. This is it. Now, if you've never worked one of these, and never seen one of these work, you're in for a surprise, because it's a very beautiful way that the old farmers had to do to go into the wheat or the rye or the barley, whatever the case was, and to use these hand holes, and they would take themselves in a certain position and sweep this through the wheat, and of course, they would cut it, and it would lay back beyond the blade on the ground. And then they would gather that and tie it into the sheave. That's where the word sheave comes from. Bundle it and put it in bundles to where it could be picked up. Or in some cases, there was what's called a cradle. It would be a gadget attached onto the back part of this blade, and it would be an arrangement of sticks made for this purpose, and the wheat would fall into the cradle, so you didn't have to pick it off the ground. You just pick it up out of the cradle. But that's what it looks like. I appreciate so much Edward bringing this tonight, letting us see it. So often, people don't see these things. They can't really visualize what it is. We think of McCormick and the reaper that he made, you know, the pull by mules. But this was a long time before mule power. This was human power. And that's precisely what they were talking about in the Bible. You remember also that back in the time of Esther was allowed to go into the field, and that she was to glean. Remember what gleaning was? Esther was told that she could go into the corners of the field, or in the case of an orchard, she could do the same thing, because this was God's law. You see, Social Security, as we know it, it's not very good. It's corrupt every way you look at it, except those who get Social Security checks. They like it. But anyway, the whole thing in a nutshell is not the best in the world, but God's way was. Because if a person didn't have anything to eat and was willing to do it, he had food available to him by law. He could go in the corner of the fields or pluck from the trees that were there, and he had the right to that by God's plan and provisions. But you remember how that Ruth, as she went through the fields to glean, were spotted by her future husband. And he told the men that when you take the wagon through the field, the cart through the field, you purposely drop off some of those sheaves. So he was letting her have an easy way to get what was available, because the law also said that if something falls off the cart, it cannot be picked up. The old law said that. And this is the instrument they used to bundle those sheaves, or cut the sheaves to be bundled. Appreciate, Edward, you bringing that, let us see it. There might be other things, too, that would help us to see what we're really talking about. Wish I had it last night. Wouldn't it have been marvelous while I'm talking about the things? We do appreciate so much in bringing that. If you would, now, you might pass out these summaries, and we'll try to go through those rapidly, because it's 7 pages, and you won't be able to, we won't be able to cover every verse or every comment on it, but just in a very brief way, to really get down to our study tonight, which is going to center on the 6th and 7th vials, the last few verses of chapter 16, beginning with, beginning with verse 12, I suppose. But before we talk about those verses, I want to lay a foundation for that, which will be found on these sheets that are being passed out. You notice that on the top and the beginning of these sheets on page 1, we have comments made in regard to Israel and the Arab history as well. And we start with Abraham. Now, we could go back to Adam, and that would be interesting, but it wouldn't be necessary, because Adam was a direct ancestor of Abraham. Abraham was a direct descendant of Adam. And you remember the story, of course, of the flood and the Tower of Babel. As they come on down to Ur of the Chaldees, which was an area of the world which existed as a city up the Euphrates River from the area of the world today you've been looking at on television, the Arabian Gulf, the Persian Gulf. And as you look at the upper end of that, you'll see where the Tigris and Euphrates River go together, and when they enter into the Gulf. Now, it's understood that back in those times, Ur was a lot closer to the sea than where its ruins have been found. And the reason why is because of the silt that has come out of those rivers has filled in the land in the north of the Persian Gulf to where now the land extends a whole lot farther than it did at one time. This is true of a number of great river systems. It's true of the Nile. It's also true of the Mississippi River. No doubt others as well. But Ur was in that area. Now, Baghdad is, you well know, probably from looking at television recently, is about 50 miles north of where Babylon was at one time on the Euphrates River. So we're talking about the area of the world today where there's been so much conflict, and where at the present time it's still certainly not settled. But Abraham was a man who lived there with Terah, his father. Remember that in Genesis chapter 15, 13, 12, God told Abraham and Terah to arise from where you are, and to go to a land that I'll show you. So they rose, and they went into the land that later on was to be known as the land of Israel, but at that time, it was called the land of promise. The reason why is simply because God promised it to Abraham. So Abraham was way over here on the Persian Gulf, which is to my right and off of the board. But if we were to go from that imaginary point up to the north, we'd find eventually coming on out to the west and back down to the south, and we would emerge to a place where my finger is, which is about the location of Old Jerusalem. Now, Jerusalem at that time was not a city, but the word Jerusalem, as you might well know, came from the idea of a place of peace. And Melchizedek was the king of this particular era at one time, but it was not a great city until after David came on the scene. But the fact is, the land, the mountains, the territory around that were the area that God said will be yours. So it was called the land of promise because of that reason. Sarah was Abraham's wife, but Sarah could have no children. Now, when she was 89 years old and Abraham was 99 years old, God told them that you will have a child next year, and they did have, and that child's name was Isaac. However, before that time, some 14 years before that time, the promise had not been fulfilled, and so Sarah suggested to Abraham that you take Hagar, my handmaiden, and have a child through her, so that, now this is not a quotation, but the effect was, so we can help God out in fulfilling his promise. You see, they had waited and waited and waited and waited and waited, and no child was born. Sarah could not have children. Abraham could, but she couldn't. And so no child was born. And the moral of this story simply is that God does not need any help. God doesn't need to be pushed to get in a hurry, and God doesn't need any help for us to establish institutions and societies and practices contrary to what he has put into vogue for us to obey. Now, God knows what he's doing. He has time enough to accomplish that. He knows what he wants, what he doesn't want. He knows what's true and what's not true. Now, when God speaks, it's the voice of authority. And when God speaks, we must listen to it, and God does not need our help. To be real frank with you, God doesn't need us at all. God doesn't need a thing in the world I have to offer to him. Not one thing. I have never been able to do anything that God couldn't have done without me. And I've never been able to do anything for God except he didn't give me a bit to do, and nor have you. God doesn't need us at all. Not a bit. We're useless as far as God requiring us, but God can use us. If we will be used, for we can be instruments in his hand to accomplish great good if we conform to what he wants us to know and do. Sarah hadn't learned that lesson yet. She soon did, because God told her, in effect, when the child was born, and there was a conflict between Ishmael, the child born to Hagar, and Isaac, God told them that the promise is coming through Isaac, not through Ishmael. Before Ishmael was born, they were told that. And in due time, sure enough, Abraham and Sarah had the son Isaac, and he grew and prospered. In the meantime, after a due time, Sarah died, and Abraham married again to a wife this time whose name was Keturah. I don't have time to go to all the beautiful, intricate details. We talked about that in the car a while ago. And it's very interesting to notice Keturah's place and how old Abraham was, and how he had six sons after he married her. But whatever the case might be, you can study that on your own. I have references for this for you to look at. Isaac, as you can see from the chart on the left-hand side, had two sons. They were named Esau and Jacob. Keturah had six sons, and Ishmael had 12 sons. In the meantime, Esau sells his birthright. Of course, you know the story, or I'd go into it, but we don't have time for that. So Esau sells his birthright. The birthright then falls to Jacob, whose name is changed to Israel. So that's where the word Israel first comes in the scene. And Israel now is the name of the people who are born to Jacob. Jacob has four wives. He has two wives, and they're two handmaidens who become his concubines. And thus, in effect, he has four wives and bears 12 sons and one daughter. We have those mentioned in the lower part of the first page. But if you look at the right part of the first page, you'll see that Hagar had a son named Ishmael, who had 12 sons, and these 12 sons became the fathers of 12 nations. And God told Abraham, when Ishmael was put away from the sight of Sarah, he said to Abraham, in effect, don't worry, Abraham, because your calling is going to come through Isaac, not through Ishmael. And you'll become the great one through Isaac, through whom the entire world will be blessed by a future son to be born. But your son Ishmael also will be blessed because he'll become the father of the 12 great nations. Now, if you look at the arrows or the dots I have on this, you'll notice now the inner mingling of these people. from the side of Esau, there was one who married the sister of Nibeshon, who was the son of Ishmael. So the sons of Esau and the sons of Ishmael intermarried. In the meantime, the disciples, the descendants of Esau, the descendants of Keturah, and the descendants of Ishmael all combined together to live in a part of the world. They were nomads. They began to distinguish among themselves and go to various parts of that general area, and they became known of as, in our day, the Arabs. So the Arabs now are the descendants of Abraham, direct descendants of Abraham, but through Ishmael and others, where the descendants of Abraham through Isaac are called simply the Israelites. And the difference between the two is that the identity was lost among the descendants of Abraham other than Israel. They moved, they migrated, they warred against each other, and there were so many, many more of those. But basically, they inherited the land of the Middle East to the east, north, and south of what we know as the Promised Land. But Israel was kept intact. They were given a piece of land. It was divided basically into 12 parts with the priests living among all the other 12. But they remained intact. And they were not separated. They were not divided. And they did not scatter themselves. They remained intact. And the reason was, you'll see from Genesis 3, God saw fit to bring forth his son through this identifiable people. And he caused them to remain intact from the time of the promise, which is in 1926 B.C., until Christ came on the scene in 4 B.C. So almost 2,000 years, God kept the Israelites intact as a people, identifiable with their priests and their laws and their genealogy, so they knew who were whom. As a consequence, then, when Jesus came, he fulfilled every single prediction of who he was to be, when he was to come, to whom he was to be born, and how he was to be born, and just so many other things about that. In fact, it's unusual, but it's a matter of truth and a matter of interest that the Bible is criticized for having two lines of descent for Jesus Christ. So the Bible certainly cannot be right. Nobody can have two lines of descent. Tain't so. Jesus did. You see, Matthew tells us Jesus was born through Joseph's line. Luke tells us Jesus was born through Mary's line. And absolutely right, because both of those were descended from David. And before that, from Judah, who was to be the head of the tribe through which Messiah was born. So God knew ahead of time, far contrary to the critics of the world today who criticize the Bible, that Jesus had two lines of descent. Both father and mother came from the right line, proving God knew ahead of time what he was talking about. As we continue on then, we notice that we will look at verse 5 and 6 of Genesis 25. Abraham gave all that he had unto Isaac. Isaac was the firstborn of choice. He was the firstborn to Sarah. She never had any more children. And he was the one to whom the promise was coming. But unto the sons of the concubines, which Abraham had, Abraham gave gifts and sent them away from Isaac his son while he yet lived. Now look at this. Eastward unto the east country. So those who were to become Arabs went to the east. The Israelites stayed in the mountains and the area where Abraham was and wherein he died, which was called then and later on to be called the land of Israel. And the same area today exists with that name as we know it from history. The arrow that I have on the right-hand side of page 1 continues on, and we won't see it anymore for quite some time, because on the left side of the pages we're going to see the continuation of the tribes of Israel. These 12 tribes went into Egyptian bondage, as we find in Genesis 15. You remember they were released from bondage, and the law was given 50 days after that release, as it's found in Exodus in 1496 B.C., as I determine the date. There were 40 years of wandering in the desert, as you know the story, and Israel eventually comes into the Promised Land, as we have mentioned on page 2, approaching it from the southeast. As they came toward the land of promise, they divided themselves into those who would inherit the land on the east of Jordan, 2.5 tribes, and those who would inherit on the west side of Jordan, 10.5 tribes, 9.5 tribes, And this would constitute the land of the 12 tribes of Israel. Thus, Israel inherited the land God had told Abraham they would have 470 years before this time. So God's kept his promise. Now, they're there. They're in the promised land. It is theirs. They're drinking from wells they didn't dig. They're living in houses they didn't build. They're eating from vineyards they didn't plant. And all this God has provided for them to enjoy and have, and now they have it. Now, here's something we need to watch carefully. I won't go in detail because I don't have the time, but you have the notes, and you can look it up for yourself. Around the world today, particularly those in our area who are concerned about premillennialism, about the thousand-year reign, about Israel's place in the Middle East, and Lord willing, we'll talk about these things in detail in June in Widawi. That's one of the subjects we'll discuss. You'll notice on page 2 that I have the notes, Promised Land Inherited. And this happened in Joshua about the time of 1456. Now, Abraham was given a promise that the land would be theirs, and it would extend from the river Euphrates in the northeast all the way through the area which was included between there and the river of Egypt. Now, the river of Egypt was not the Nile. Nile is in Egypt. But the river of Egypt is that which was in the Sinai Peninsula. You can see it on your maps if you want to. It was to the east of the Nile. But all the way from the river of Egypt, all the way up to the Euphrates, was to be their land. God told them that they would have that land. It would be theirs to have. Quite a long territory. So there are those today on the scene who say, now wait a minute, Israel has never received that territory. They never have had it. All they're thinking about is the little piece of land Israel enjoyed at the time that the Romans came on the scene. But that's not so at all. Israel has inherited every single inch of land God ever promised them. It was theirs. Now, they didn't keep it, but it was theirs, it was given to them. The argument is that today, so many of those who want to think of Israel as being something special and the apple of God's eye, which the Bible says they were, and that they have never inherited promise, therefore they must go back to the Middle East, they must inherit the Middle East land, it must be theirs once more, they're absolutely mistaken. The reason why is because during the days of David and Solomon, Israel obtained, lived in, and enjoyed every single inch of land from the Euphrates River all the way down through Syria and that part of the world under the river of Egypt. Now the Bible tells us that. Look, if you will, at the land which was to be encompassed in Genesis 15, Deuteronomy 1, and Joshua 1, as I have mentioned on these pages. Now, they were warned about the inheritance of that land. But later on, the promise was absolutely fulfilled because Joshua 21, reading verses 4 and 3 and 45, tell us that Israel inherited every bit of the land they were promised to have. So Israel, in the past, has had that land, and it is not to be expected anymore today. Now, I wish I had about 45 minutes to go into these verses. I don't have. So read those on your own, if you will. You have them before you to read. The fact is, though, in Deuteronomy 9, verses 5 and 6, Israel is told, you're going to have all this land, not at all because you're so good or you're so righteous or you're so pretty or because I like you better than anybody else. They were not told that. Israel was told, the reason I'm giving you this land is because of the wickedness of the people that's in it. I'm going to drive them out and let you live there. Now, they were warned that these people are wicked, therefore I'm going to let you have that land. In fact, as Genesis was telling us of Abraham's promise, God told Abraham that your people are going to go into the land of bondage, and in the fourth generation they will come out. Now, they went into the land of bondage, Egypt, 215 years after the promise to Abraham. They stayed there for 215 years, which makes 430 years. And then when they came out, they inherited the promised land 40 years later. But the fact is, God told them this. He said, the reason they must stay there for the fourth generation is that the wickedness of the Amorites is not yet full. He did not want the children of Israel to live among the Amorites and become wicked with them, so he drove them out, put them in slavery. In fact, what he did was protect them for 215 years. Then when the Amorites became so wicked and so vile they needed to be destroyed, he let Israel come back and do it. Now, God uses things that way. He doesn't get in a hurry. We don't always understand why he waits and why he does what he does, but he always has a plan and a purpose. And don't ever underestimate God. So Israel comes back now, not because they were so good or righteous, but because those people were so wicked, God said, I'm going to let you have the land. I need to say this now, I suppose. I may forget if I don't, and I'm not sure I'll find a better place to put it. Over in the Middle East, as you talk to, as I did, many, many of the Arabs, they don't like the idea of having been pushed away from their homeland by the Israelites, or by the Israelis, we call them today, and by the United Nations making that possible. They repel the idea of it, just like our Indian friends do in our nation. And when you talk about the rights and the homeland, they have told me this to my face. They say, you people in America took the land away from the Indians. It was their land, and you took it away from them. Now, when you give your land back to the Indians, then we'll consent to our land going back to the Jews. But until you do, don't talk to us. They say because Israel had the land, it was their land. We know it was their land, but they disobeyed God. And God took it away from them and gave it to us. Now the United Nations takes it from us and gives it back to them. And that's not right, so they say. And it's at a point. And so they say, when you let the Indians have that United States land again, then talk to us, but not until then. So you don't argue much about that. Because by all rights, we took the land from the Indians. And by all rights, the United Nations, or by all non-rights, the United Nations took away from the Arabs and gave it to the Israelis, and that's the reason they're there today. Now, I think it was known by God it would happen. I don't doubt that at all. But the people in Israel today are not God's chosen people. The people in Israel today have no royal right to that land in the United States. Because we today, as Christians, are the Israel of God, and the land they obtain over there, the land they live in and possess over there, is not what they deserve. It's not what they have a right to. It's not what God's given them back to have because they are the good, righteous people, but because simply that God predicted there would be a problem in the Middle East and this would be involved in it. We're going to read about that later on tonight. So Israel, at times past, as we're going to read in the book of Joshua 21 and other related verses, Israel in times past inherited every single inch of land, God ever intended for them to have, and they had no promise of any more land. Now that'll answer, I hope, a number of the critics today about our position against Israel. We're not really against Israel, because they have as much right to be Christians as anybody does, and that's precisely where we stand. Okay? Now in the middle part of page 2, you'll notice that there was a time of 14 judges. This amounted to about 450 years, followed by an era of the kings, which lasted from about 1100 B.C. down to about 587 B.C. This is where Saul, David, and Solomon lived and were kings. And then in about 980, the kingdom was divided into two parts. You have Israel on one side and Judah on the other. Israel was the rebellious portion of Israel, which followed a man whose name was Jeroboam, whereas Judah was the two southern tribes centering around Jerusalem in that area, and they were led by the rightful king Rehoboam. Now, Israel maintained their independence until they were conquered by the Assyrians, this is on page 3, in 721 B.C. Among them, there existed 9 dynasties, which simply means 9 different families from which the king came, and there were 19 kings. On the side of Judah, which is the rightful tribe or section of Israel, there were 20 kings from the same one family, which was, of course, the family of David and, of course, Saul in the background. And we have this then being conquered in 587 by the Babylonians, as you remember our story earlier. So we come down in time to the middle part of page 3, where we find that there was a return now from Babylonian captivity after 70 years into the land of promise once more. In 517, the temple was erected. Judah returns. They now become known of as the Jews. So you'll find 3 terms relating to these people in the latter part of the Old Testament. Jews, Israel, and Judah. Now, prophecy foretells in chapter 2 of Daniel, as we've already discovered, that there would be 4 kingdoms arise on the earth, Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. That would be followed in turn by another kingdom called the Kingdom of God, which we've identified and which we have found would stand forever. We have some identifying characteristics on page 4 letting us know how to identify the time and the place of this kingdom, because we find that it was to be near the time these verses were written, It was to be at a time that would shortly follow the death of Christ, and there would be some then living who would not die till they see the kingdom come. The kingdom then is not yet future. It's not down the stream of time somewhere, and we'll talk about that tomorrow morning. And it's not something which had been established in John's day or before his day, but had to be established after Christ's death and while some of them were still living, as we noted in Mark 9, verse 1. Then Jerusalem, as you know, and I said it also too, has fallen to the control of the Romans, because in 70 A.D. it was destroyed and the Jews were scattered throughout the earth. Now, we must hesitate here because we must look at two verses of Scripture which will give us a great deal of insight into what was about to occur and to what we'll find now with Revelation. The first of these we'll mention is in the book of Romans, chapter 11. Paul is talking now to the church in Rome and explaining to them some things that had to do with the future from that time forward. And chapter 11 is a continuation of chapter 10, in which the same subject matter is discussed. And there, in effect, Paul says there are two olive trees. There is the olive tree that is tame and produces good olives, and it's favorable and well, but a branch on the olive tree is called the Jew. Now, that branch is broken off for some reason. Therefore, they went out to a wild olive tree, wild by nature, and today as we were passing by, I didn't have time to say it, but I was looking at the hills to the south of the road from here to Naco, and I was just looking at the size of the trees and the way the terrain looked, and I could almost imagine those being olive trees. Looked just like they do in the Middle East. They were larger than your mesquite. I don't know what they were. But the whole hillside was covered with looked like olive trees. I know they weren't, but they sure looked like it. And that part looked just like Israel. Anyway, Israel had now themselves broken from this tree. So they went out into the wilds. They got a branch from a wild olive tree, and it was grafted in where the Jews had been broken off. Now, of course, God's trying to tell us something through that figure, and simply it was this, that Israel, who disobeyed God, and just like the Amorites had done, and just like Israel did time and time and time again in the Old Testament era, they disobeyed God, they did not receive God's Son, so they were broken off. And then instead of them, the Gentiles, which include you and me, were grafted in their place. And then Paul goes ahead and says, but you Gentiles, be extra cautious, because if the ones who were God's chosen people could be broken off, and you could be grafted in their stead, then you could be broken off too. So watch yourself, lest you behave in such a way God also will cast you off. Now with that in mind, we go down to chapter 11 and verse 25. Now let's read verse 24. For if thou wert cut out of the olive tree which is wild by nature, and wert grafted contrary to nature into a good olive tree, how much more shall these, which be the natural branches, be grafted into their own olive tree? Now verse 25. For I would not, brethren, that you should be ignorant of this mystery, lest you should be wise in your own conceit, that blindness in part, now that's the important key to this verse, blindness in part, it happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. The West. It went to Antioch, to Turkey, and then eventually across the sea over to the first church in Europe, Philippi. From Philippi down into Greece, then to Rome, to Central Europe, to England, and eventually to America. Now that's the spread of the truth. In fact, in Paul's day, he said that he intended to go to Spain. So I don't know whether he ever got there or not. It doesn't tell us. But we do know that in the 300s, the Gospels were being preached in Great Britain, and a man's name was doing it was named Bede, B-E-D-E. So the Gospel spread to the West and basically to the Gentiles, and primarily the Church of our Lord was filled with the Gentiles who became Christian. Thus they lost their Gentile identity. And the Jews, when they become Christians, lose their identity as well, and we all become one in Christ. Remember that Jesus said in John 10, other sheep I have which are not of this fold, are of the Gentiles.
I'll bring them in. There'll be one foe and one shepherd. He was predicting here in the Christian church as really being identified as one solid group as opposed to two sections, Jew and Gentile. He wiped down that middle wall of partition through Christ's shed blood on the cross. And in due time, the Gentiles came in. Now he said, blindness in part, which seems to let us know that Israel has the capacity, and there's every good likeness that in time to come, from that time, some Jews would respond to Christianity. Thus blindness in part, not in whole, not totally, but blindness in part is happened to the Jews until the fullness of the Gentiles did come in. So the Gentiles had a period of time he calls their fullness. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But before we do, I want to read back over in the book of Luke now, chapter 21 and verse 24. Now in Luke, Christ is talking to us, and notice the similarity of the things which he has in mind with what Paul had to say. Now Luke 21's companion verse, chapter to Matthew 24. Jesus said, and they shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be led away captive into all nations. And Jerusalem shall be trodden out of the Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles be fulfilled. So we have two verses, one by Jesus and one by Paul, which give us almost the same idea. He says here that there is a fullness of a time which is allowed the Gentiles. We've already shown how that the gospel spread among the Gentile world freely, rapidly, with a regular effect, so that even in the early years, in the 300s, Christianity was made the official religion of the Roman Empire. So it had spread like wildfire through that part of the world. And as God would have it, it spread to every honest soul who accepted it. Of course, there are many hypocrites. And there was a counterfeit church that arose, which we have already read about. The fact is, the Gentile Western world primarily is that part of the world who accepted Christianity. Not where the Muslims were, not where the Jews were. Primarily in Europe and in the West. Now let's watch what happened. As the gospel affected those people in those days, in that age, you can see progress as never before. Look at the Western powers throughout the years. Women, for one thing, began to be treated like humans as opposed to cattle to be traded back and forth. They were not slaves. They were not considered like slaves. They began to have respect and honor among the Western world. Little by little, they gained in the image that God would have them to have, that they were companions of the husband and not to be walked on by the husband. Now, this is contrary to what it had been before that time. Also, you notice a number of things that began to be developed in the Western civilization. Some of those you can easily recognize. For one thing, movable type began to be used in Germany so that the Bible could be printed and spread at a rate it had never enjoyed before that time. All kind of medical advance was being made. In fact, eventually, it was determined in the Western part of the world, that's the part of Europe, that there was in our bodily systems a series of canals, which we learned to call veins, and other arteries and tracts, and vessels through which blood circulated. He was determined that these were tied together by capillaries and that this had the ability of bringing into our body food and oxygen and taking the waste out of our body. Marvelous introduction into the knowledge of mankind. And from that, there's all kind of medical advance which has been made. That was in the Western part of the world. Look at the electric light, the telephone, the telegraph, the television. Well, some of those we can do without. And then there are all kinds of things such as the internal combustion engine, the use of gasoline, steam power, and we could just go on and on and on, the sewing machine, and all kinds of things which have been invented and developed for the benefit and betterment of mankind. And most of this thrust has been from the Western part of the world and now is shared by all the world around the globe. But God has seen fit to bless our part of the world in a way the world had not been blessed before. In technical and medical and scientific and moral standards the world had never enjoyed. And basically because we had seen fit to accept the Bible. We allowed the Bible to influence our laws, our politics, our schooling, and every phase of our Western civilization was infiltrated by the effect of the Bible. And the Bible, of course, brought the knowledge of Christ. And that's the reason the Western part of the world basically were Christians, or at least Christian-oriented.
And God blessed us to no end. Now, I've written some material on this. Brother Ray published it in his paper in two different segments. It's quite long, and if you want a copy, I think I have a copy with me. We can make some photostats of it. And I go in detail about what I'm just talking to you here now about. I don't have time to give it all. And in that track, if you want to, you're welcome to read it. But it shows that Western civilization has been blessed by God as no other people ever have been, to the point at which we made advancement and conquest and development, an ease of life, and an advance in materialism that the world had never enjoyed. To the point at which finally we reached a peak, our fullness, and we went over the top, started going down the other side. And that's where we are today. God allowed us to reach a peak at which He blessed us and cared for us, nurtured us, as no people had ever been before, except perhaps Israel during their heyday. To the point at which finally we became so self-sufficient and so satisfied and so worldly-minded and so materialistic in nature and so humanistic in nature that we left the Bible out of our picture. We were Bible-believing, and that's the reason we spread like we did in this nation. And that's the reason we're able to make the conquest we have over various parts of the world and so many areas, because we were Bible-believing and God blessed us and cared for us, nurtured us, because here was where Christianity would have its greatest growth, where it had the fertile soil to bloom and to grow, as I mentioned last night. He blessed this part of the world to be the place where that restoration would take place. But then after we become so self-sufficient, and we begin to brag about things, as Paul said here, don't do that, because as Israel could be cut off, so can you be cut off. We begin to look at ourselves with such glory and honor and self-praise and self-acclaim, feeling that in effect we really don't need God. We begin to turn aside from Him. Our moral standards, our governmental officials, our schooling criteria. Every way we turn now, we lift God out of the picture. We reached a peak, and now we have turned over and gone down the other side. And mark my word, I'm not a prophet inspired. Only from experience in history, we'll never turn around again. I'm sad to say that. It doesn't have to be that way, but it will be that way. We're doomed. We will not come back. We'll be destroyed. I'm sorry it's that way, but it is. If we look at the traditions of the world and the way we've gone, unless there's awakening in our nation that has never been experienced among us before, we are doomed, because we have reached that peak and have turned around. And that peak occurred in about 1948. Now, those of you who can remember, as I can, back being in school, there's not a one of us who would even dare think about walking on the American flag. Back when you was in school, would you even think of such a thing? We waved that flag high, and we were proud of that flag, because it stood for something. Let me give another illustration. Teachers back in my day were people of respect, of knowledge. They were a source of information. They were some of the elite of the community. Our teachers. Now, we didn't always listen to them. And it was the case that if we disobeyed in school, we'd go home that night and our parents would whip us again. You remember the old story? Because that teacher was one who was to be respected. And that was the way it was, not the way it should have been. Today, they're divorced. They're living with another companion, not even their own husband or wife. They're immoral. They don't really care about what they're doing. They're looking for a paycheck. Now, that's not true of every one of them, of course. Though it's not true of every one of us to be immoral or unconcerned or materialistic, but by and large, that's where our nation stands. I remember talking to some teachers, one of them in particular who died back when she was about 105 years old. Debbie and Ray knew her well, knew Dolly. She was an honorable woman. She was very talented, very controlled. She had dignity. She died at 105, if I recall right. She told me back when she was 17 years old, she said, my first job, and she began to tell me about it. You see, back at that time, you didn't have a board of education. You didn't have some group up in Washington snapping their finger and saying, if you don't do what we want, we'll cut off your tax dollars. That's where we are today. You didn't have that. You had a community who hired the teacher. And the teacher usually boarded with one of the families during the school year, and the whole community paid the teacher. Probably the equivalent of about $1.75 a month week, but whatever the case was, she was suspected, and she was hired, and she stayed there, and she did her job well during that school year, and she was listened to, or he was, the case might be. But at 17, she got her first job like this. She told me the story. She said there were two young girls who were trying to get this job. I was one of them, and there was another girl. And she was as well qualified as I was. Neither one of us would have fit the qualifications real well for that job, but they chose me. And then after they chose me and I was hired, they told me this. They said, "Do you know why we hired you? We want you to know." They said, "We know your father. We know his reputation. We know the family you come from. We hired you, not because you were better than the other girl, but because we knew from your family background you'd be dependable and honest and the one who would hold up your family reputation." You see, back in those days, a family name meant something. Back in those days, you wouldn't dare steal a hubcap. They didn't have them back then. You wouldn't dare do something that was wrong or improper or immoral, because if you did, it would bring shame on your family. You see, those were the good old days. Oh, sure, you had to walk through 3 foot of snow, 10 miles to school. I know that old story, but it's not quite that bad. But you did have responsibility. You had interest in the well-being of your friends and the community and your family. You worked with your hands to enjoy what you desired to have, and it wasn't given to you on a silver platter. You had responsibility and you had respect for where you were and what you were. We've lost that. Now we want the world to give us a living. Now we want to enjoy vacations and retirement funds and all those kind of things that go with the materialistic world. We have reached a peak to where we are at a point now we're going to the other side. And the time that occurred is about 1948. If you notice carefully in looking at our history, our music seemed to change at that time. Our philosophy about life began to change at that time. Our school curricula began to change at that time. There were all kind of governmental problems that took place at that time. And at that time, there seemed to have been a change. Now, if you want to say 49 or 50, that's okay with me. I'm giving that as a round figure, and you'll see in a minute why I give that date. For Easter peak, they returned and gone the other way. I think that's the fullness of the Gentiles to come in. Up to that time, our nation was admired, respected. It had the praise of the entire world. We were honored. But after that time, we lost our image. Every way we turned, we were hated, and we were spoken against, spit on by the peoples of the world. We were the people who had money, and that's all we cared about. And they knew it. And if they could get hold of our money, that was fine and well, but they didn't have regard for us. And that's the way it was after 1948. Let's see now what happens. Jesus said in chapter 21, now we've been talking about what Paul had to say back over here, the fullness of Gentiles. Jesus said in chapter 21 of Luke, verse 24, of the destruction of Jerusalem and the fact that the Jews in that destruction would be a scattered people. Now, Josephus tells you a story of that. Some of you have that book. Read it if you wish to. They were slaughtered. Jerusalem was battered down. Christ tells them in Matthew 24 to pray that your flight be not in winter, not on the Sabbath day, that women not be pregnant, or they not be nursing a child that time. Indicating it was to be a time of speed, a time of being aware, to quickly act, a time when they had to flee from the safety and security of the Jerusalem walls across the land to Pella on the other side of the Jordan River to escape. And Jesus told them very emphatically, this is going to come. And watch these signs, because when it comes, flee. Don't go back in your house. Don't make preparation, but flee then because of the abomination spoken of by Daniel. So we tie that back in again. And sure enough, that time came. So that when that time came, the Christians knew to flee from the city, get away from it, for some strange, unknown reason to Josephus. The armies of Rome pulled back from that conquest of Jerusalem. For some unknown reason, you know why, I know why, because God pulled them back. The Christians took notice of that fact and they fled immediately. As far as we know, not a single Christian lost his life. And then the armies of Rome came back and literally destroyed the city in a very awful way. as Daniel said they would. Now, when they were scattered, after they were conquered, they were scattered throughout the then known world, and the Jews never again had a homeland until 1948. And that's the reason I tie that in with the downfall of America. 1948, because of the United Nations, which basically means the United States, they were allowed to go back to their homeland and once again inherit the land, pushing the Arabs back out of it. Now listen to what Jesus said. They shall fall by the edge of the sword and shall be led away captive into all nations. So Jesus tells us there that something would occur that would cause the Jews to be led away captive into all nations. And they were. You remember the atrocities spoken of up in Germany? You remember how they were chased people? How they were run from place to place to place throughout southern Russia and all over that part of the world? Many of them fled to America, many of them to South America. They were scattered throughout the entire world from 70 AD and did not return until 1948, when at that time, the United Nations carved out a very little section of the Middle East and named it Israel. It went from the Sinai Desert up to the Golan Heights. It did not touch the Jordan River. It did not include Jerusalem in 1948. Now Jesus said they would be scattered among all nations until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. But then notice what else he said. He said, Jerusalem shall be trodden down the Gentiles under the times the Gentiles be fulfilled. Now Jerusalem did fall to the Jews. But Jerusalem fell to the Jews when? In 1967. During the Seven-Day War. And the exact way he puts this is the exact way it happened. In 48, the land was once more given to the Jews, not Jerusalem. But in 67, the Jerusalem then fell to the Jews where they possess it now. This is what he said would happen, and this is what has happened. That's where we stand today. So what does this have to do with us? Well, let's look at our paper again. On page 4, we notice that Jerusalem fell to the Romans. Who were the Romans? Gentiles. Now watch the word Gentile. Jesus said that the Gentiles would possess this land and dominate this land and this city until their time came. Paul said the same thing will be true. The Gentiles will have a time coming and they'll possess this and dominate it until that time comes. First of all then, the Romans possessed this land in 70 AD and they maintain it. The Jews are scattered according to the scriptures we had just mentioned. And then a number of other verses I have tied that I won't mention just now. Jerusalem was trodden down. Israel was scattered. Rome now held control of this land and this city until 638 A.D. And that's at the time when the Byzantine Empire came on the scene as the eastern section of the Roman Empire. And it was conquered in 638 A.D. by Islam. Again, these are not the Jews. These are an outside force. The Jews still don't have that land. The other day we talked about Islam a little bit. I won't go into that tonight, but I have a number of notes for you to read to identify these people, some of their practices, what they believe, where they came from, and such like, but we discussed that earlier. Now, Islam held control of Jerusalem and Israel from 638 until 1076, as I have notes on page 6. Again, you have the Jews and Jerusalem conquered by an outside force. The Jews did not have control of either the land or Israel from the time of 70 A.D. now all the way down to 1076, at which time the Turks came on the scene. As you remember, they advanced toward the west, eventually taking control of it. And so the Ottoman Turks take control of that part of the world and maintained it until 1919. Now, the Ottoman Turks are those later on we begin to recognize as Turkey. Ottoman Empire was in vogue, in force at that time, had control over Jerusalem and Israel. This, again, is the Gentile power, not Jewish at all. So Jews now, from 70 AD up to 1919, have been absolutely out of control of their land. Jerusalem was under control of the feet of the Gentiles, as God said, Christ said they would, back in Luke 21. However, in 1919, there was a mandate issued because of the defeat of the Turks by the Allied forces at the end of the First World War to the point at which control was given to the British. The British maintained control. Who are the British? Not Jewish. The British are Gentile. The British had control of Jerusalem and Israel until 1948. So, from 70 AD to all these things we mentioned until 1948, Jerusalem and Israel was under absolute control of Gentile powers. Exactly what Paul said, exactly what Christ would be, and it was that way until this time. Thus, we have seen the fullness of the Gentiles becoming in. That's the reason I put the time here of the Euphrates River we're going to speak about in just a moment, 1948. It seems to fit as the next date forward in our process of time that has to do with the Middle East and Jerusalem and Israel, and I think very, very well brings it down to our time of which we're speaking today. With this in mind now, we turn to the book of Revelation, chapter 16, and continue in our comments from verse 12, if I remember the proper verse. And the sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates. Now, why are we talking about Euphrates again? Well, we've talked about it in times past, several times. The Euphrates seems to have been that barrier between the east on one hand and the west on the other hand. Now, the Euphrates River is not a large enough river to present a major problem. It had been crossed for thousands of years by those who would travel from one side to the other. But God uses it here, as he has a number of times used other things, to simply make this a mark of distinction between the east and the west. All these things have come to a highlight to the point at which we have seen God's favor throughout the ages up until 1948. Now we're about to get into a part of the world where pagan Rome has fallen, imperial Rome has fallen, and now papal Rome has been brought to its knees. God's not through with them yet. But as the scene changes from Rome proper and to the other part of the Roman Empire under the trumpets, we now find the scene changing from the bringing of the Pope to his knees and the papacy to its absolute astonishment before the world, because that's the words we read last night about them. We come now to look at some other events that are going on that will involve Rome by all means, but are going to extend beyond Rome now and bring things to something we have not heard before. That is the fact that before we have talked about the land, the sea, the rivers, the sun, and the territory. The time of the vials, we've been talking about the earth, the sea powers, the rivers in Central Europe. The sun was darkened when the whole Pope was humiliated. The Vatican territory was limited. Now we turn our thoughts to the division between the east and the west, and now, for the first time in all of Revelation, read of something we have not read about yet, and that is the vials going to be poured out in the air. We have not mentioned the air before. It's never been brought to our mind yet. Well, all of a sudden, it's completely changed everything we've been talking about and mentioned the air. We continue on. The Euphrates River is that symbolic line. It's real. But also serves as a symbolic barrier between the east and the west. You remember when the Turks were coming over, they stopped the Euphrates River for 60 years. Then they proceeded to go beyond it and conquer Rome. Now here the Euphrates River is that line of division between the east on one side and the west on the other. And the waters thereof was dried up. Why? Well, they were not really dried. They're still flowing. But they were dried up in the sense of a figure of speech. So there'd be no barrier anymore. Dried up that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared. And I saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, out of the mouth of the beast, out of the mouth of the false prophet. Now we have something here that's going to involve what we've talked about already, but in the meantime, we have another force coming from the east and from the west. Let's see what we can decide about this for just a moment, and something I think that's rather interesting to observe. The east and the west symbolize the entire world, really. Because at one time the world was a great mass of people and lands and islands and seas and mountains where there was very little communication between each of those. It would take literally months to travel from Spain to America. It would take an unimaginable time to go around the entire world. Captain Cook, you know, tried it, was killed in Hawaiian Islands as he was in the middle of his trip. Took literally months and months and months to even think about going around the entire globe. But that's not the case today. In fact, in 1927, Lindbergh, whom some of you have heard about, his plane, by the way, is in the Smithsonian Institution today, and you can see that if you want to see that same old plane. Quite a bit different from what it is today. The airplane he flew in was not as long as from here to that back wall. An old, dilapidated, ancient-looking plane, but it was in only in 1927. What did you fly in today, Ray? 727? Can you imagine the difference in the size and the power of those planes? Back in Lindbergh's day, he and a little kitty cat he had with him took 33.5 hours to go from New York to Paris, France. 33.5 hours. Ray, do you remember how long it took you last time you flew from Europe to New York? May have, because it'll take you about that time on a relatively slow plane to Switzerland, which is where I land in Europe. But from Paris, which is closer, it'll take you less than that. Less than 8 hours. So 33.5 hours on one side versus 8 hours on the other side. Not too long ago, I flew from Los Angeles to Atlanta, Georgia in 5 hours. Monstrous amount of speed. Took me 3 days to drive out here from Birmingham in a car. 5 hours from Los Angeles to Atlanta. You see, what we are talking about is the fact that we have been able, by God's blessings, to have technological advance to the point at which the world has been shrunk. That's been dehydrated. Not by taking the water away from it, but because of our advance, the world has actually been shrunk to where it's not the great expanse of territory it one time was. I dare say that some of you lately have been able to pick up the telephone and in a matter of literally less than a minute speak to somebody on the other part of the world. Not long ago, I did to India. The call came through crisp and clear with almost no hesitation. The operator handled the call. Brother Bill calls from Mexico up to Arizona. And by the time the dial is used, and the phone rings up here in Valter's home, it's a matter of just a split second. It takes more time than that to have the girl at the counter wait on us than it does to get the call through. But the idea is that the world's been shrunk by means of transportation, by means of communication, and all other kind of things that we haven't mentioned. The world has been shrunk, and that's one little ball, and what involves you involves somebody on the other side of the world you don't even know. And some little war over there that breaks out is going in somewhere or another involve you some way. What the Lord has seen fit to do is bring the entire world into one little mass now, because our attention is where? Look at the air. Our attention now is on one world as opposed to the great distinction it used to be in times past. Now that's what we're seeing here by the Euphrates being drawn up. The Euphrates is dried, so the world has been drawn to one little mass. And we're going to see now world involvement in everything that goes on. The East and the West now are no longer separated. They're drawn together by the symbolic drying up of the Euphrates River. This having been done, we're going to see the East and the West come together, and then there's going to emerge this great source of error and problems and harm, which we have been seeing earlier. Three unclean spirits like frogs. Back when I was a little boy in school, I loved to play with frogs. I'd chase frogs. But you know what? They're loathsome creatures to me today. I wouldn't dare play with frogs. Not afraid of them. There's just no object in it. I dare say most of the women here, I know the little girls here, wouldn't dare touch frogs. Why? They're loathsome creatures. They're not really dirty. But they don't look good. Looks like they got warts all over them. We don't want to play with those things. That's the reason John uses these here. Because it takes something loathsome that we don't want to touch or have to do with because it presents an awful image. And that's the reason he uses those, no doubt here. Three unclean spirits. We're talking about spirits. We're not talking about frogs, really. Three unclean spirits, he describes them as frogs, come out of the mouth of the dragon. Remember we discussed that earlier? That's the devil. Remember the serpent in the Garden of Eden? And chapter 12 told us in several terms what it was. So we have the devil, and out of the mouth of the beast. And remember the seven-headed beast here? Climaxed by the papacy in the Holy Roman Empire. This again is involved. And out of the mouth of the false prophet is involved. These are, I think, identified first of all by Revelation 12, verse 9, and then by Daniel 7, and by Revelation 17 mentions the beast. And then in Revelation 19, verse 20, he speaks of the false prophet as being the Pope. So here we have these same three on the scene again to be involved in this world conflict that's on the horizon. For they are the spirits of devils working miracles. They're not going to come with ignorance or without ability. They're going to be slick and effective and active and acceptable, which go forth unto the kings of the earth and the whole world to do what? To do what the devil wants, to gather them to the battle of the great day of God Almighty. So these forces of evil are going to be gathered together. He's going to use the same old elements he's had in times past to do it, bring it about. They're going to be gathered together unto the battle. Now remember the word battle. Behold, I come as a thief. Blessed is he that watcheth and keepeth his garments, lest he walk naked and they see his shame. He says, watch out. Be careful. Be clean. Be pure. Be holy. Be watchful. Because let these things take you and you don't be, are not aware of what's going on. And he gathered them together into a place called in the Hebrew tongue, Armageddon. Armageddon is the term being spoken of here. It's a place under consideration. But Armageddon here is mentioned four times, I think, in the Old Testament. Now, twice it's spoken of having to do with a battle of old Israel involving King Josiah. The next time it has to do with a battle involving Deborah, the judge of Israel. And then the third time in Zechariah 12, it's used to refer in a general way as to the conflicts taking place at a place in the Hebrew called Hill Megiddo, or in the Old Testament Hebrew language, had to do with a mountain or a hill at a place called Megiddo. So here we have a place up in northern Israel, which at one time, or several times, was a battleground for Israel and its enemies. We're not really talking about that battleground. We're not really talking about the Hill Megiddo. What we are speaking about simply is that he uses this from the Old Testament and brings it forward to give us the idea of a great battle, just like he uses old Babylon time and time and time again, and he uses old Rome time and time and time again. He uses that old wicked Jezebel time and time again to bring her forth to us to give us a picture of the awfulness he's talking about. So here the old ancient battleground of Israel is not really the place we're talking about. It's so small that today you could not even begin to put a modern army there. So we're not talking about a modern battle on an ancient battlefield that they wouldn't even fit into anyway. He's merely giving this, like the other things, as a symbol of a conflict that's about to take place. And he says it is a battle, and he says it's at a place called Armageddon. Now, there are those of our brethren who say the battle of Armageddon is not mentioned at all in the Bible. Well, they're right if they talk about a technical phrase and put quotation marks on the end of it. The battle of Armageddon is not mentioned. But how stupid can we be? He mentions battle in one verse. He mentions the place in the next verse. He ties battle with Armageddon, and it's just foolish for us to ignore the fact they're both mentioned in the same area. What we're trying to do, of course, is to oppose the view of so many of our thousand-year reign advocates, and we try to oppose them by showing there is no battle of Armageddon mentioned in the Bible. Well, it's not mentioned, but it's there, very plainly there. Let me suggest something to you. We've talked over and over and over again in our studies about symbolic terms and about picture language. But every time we've been talking about places and cities and events that have to do with our history. We're talking about actual nations and actual leaders and actual movements in literal geographical locations and times. We've been talking about wars that took place, the people who were involved in it, the effect of it on actual human beings. We've been talking about real places like the Euphrates River. And all these things, we've been talking about something you put your finger on and give an actual place and a time and a name and an event. If that's so, then why all of a sudden do we say, well, the Battle of Armageddon is just simply a conflict between truth and error? And that's so often what our brethren boil it down to. When they get to this point in our study, they just say it's a symbolic picture between the battle of truth and error. Well, the battle of truth and error has been going on since creation. This is nothing new. I don't think the battle of Armageddon is simply that easy. It's not just something that we can wipe away by saying it's just a battle between truth and error. So many of our brethren do that. So many of our digressive brethren and writings do that too. Why all of a sudden would God be talking about real places and times and events and things and names and dates, and then all of a sudden just wipe it all away by saying, well, that's a great battle of truth and error, and the truth's going to be triumphant. Well, the truth will be triumphant. We're going to talk about that later on and talk about that symbolic battle between truth and error. We'll do that tomorrow. But we're talking now about things which climax the seven trumpets. It seems to me that he's bringing the East and the West together for some reason. It seems to me he pictures the Middle East as a focal point of all this. It seems to me he's drawing everything to a climax and showing there's not much time left. There are not many events yet to occur. We're coming to the end of the last days. So certainly why can't this figure a great conflict which is to from his day, which was to occur? I think that's exactly what he's talking about. Who needed oil until the last part of the 1800s? Nobody. Why are we finding so much oil in the Middle East today? What does Hussein's part play in this? Why is Iraq all of a sudden on the forefront? Now, don't you misunderstand me a minute. I don't think Hussein is not a thing in the world with a big bump on the big globe. He doesn't have a great deal to play. And he's not significant. His name's not even mentioned in the Bible, nor is he but very little thought of, except in a general way. But he does play a role, like so many others have played a role, for example, Hitler, in allowing the Jews to be under such pressure they would demand a homeland, and we gave in and gave them one. And that was a role he played, and others have played similar roles to that. But Saddam Hussein is simply a matter of one event, of many events, that seems to be drawing the world together into a great conflict, which is going to explode into the end of the world. Now, I'm getting to a point at which I don't know what I'm talking about. You know I don't. Because we're talking about the future. We're talking about things which have not occurred. I've already suggested to you that the only way we know what Revelation is talking about or any other book of prophecy is by taking world history and looking at it after it's already occurred. So I don't know what's going to happen. I can't tell you what's going to happen. And don't even think that I can, because I don't. But what I do see is this. We have been drawn together in some great conflict that seems to be on the horizon. This must have started sometime around the First World War, because that's when the East and the West began to be drawn together. It was heightened in the Second World War. It was even made more close by a number of nations all over the world beginning to be in a conflict wherein oil was a very important element, and now it seems to be centering on the Middle East. That's where I think I see us going. Beyond that point, I don't really know. But it goes a little farther. As we look now at verse 17. And the seventh angel poured out his vial into the air. Now, since everything else has been local, or has been in an area, or has involved certain places and times and situations, it seems to me that the air is that which has no restrictions. The seas bind our shores. The rivers divide nations and states. We have geographical divisions mentioned several times in Revelation, but all of a sudden, we have an element that has no boundary to it, the air. I think that very easily represents the entire world. It's something that spreads throughout the entire world, involves the entire world, and we've been led to look at that from the sixth vial. And there came a great voice out of the temple of heaven from the throne saying, "It is done." Now, whatever he had in mind to accomplish, he says, is being accomplished in this seventh vial. That's the reason I feel that we are right here. We've come past the Euphrates River. We are at the point where the East and the West has been gathered together. Great turmoil and conflict is going on. It seems that our entire world focus now is upon materialism and upon humanism, as opposed to the great spiritual values that we as a Western power at one time valued. They're gone. It seems to me that we are here. I don't think we're quite the air yet. I don't think the seventh vial has been poured out, but I do think the sixth has, and we are a long way into the sixth vial and are closely approaching the seventh. The date, I don't know. I think we've come up to 1948. I think because Jerusalem fell to the Jews in 1967, we've come that far, but beyond that point, I can't tell you. Now let's go a little farther. He said, there was a voice which said, it is done. And there were voices and thunders and lightnings, and there was a great earthquake. Now, you know, because of our previous studies, this is not just an earth tremble. This has to do with a violent shaking of the nations of the world, such as was not since men were upon the earth, so mighty an earthquake and so great. And the great city was divided into three parts. What city are we talking about? I don't know. I can tell you two real possibilities. One of those is the city of Rome, and I don't mean Rome in Italy. I mean the Roman Catholic powers, which now are called that great city. And the reason why is because it was mentioned twice, I think, in Revelation as being a great city. One of those was in Revelation 17, verse 18, and Revelation 14, verse 8. Twice it mentions Rome, or the Roman Catholic powers, as a great city. So it could be that